Welcome, everybody. News of the Money World. I'm Darcy Ongaro. You are Rupert Carline. How are you, Rupert?
I'm very well. How are you, Darcy?
Fantastic. I was just saying before, we were doing some stretches before, so I'm feeling really good. We've got our intellectual muscles stretched as well as our neck muscles to cover all of the news events that have happened in the world. And we are spoiled for choice. So shall we get stuck into the first topic? I want to talk to you about Main Street and Wall Street. Main Street is starting to feel a little bit raggedy. Wall Street is looking amazeballs. So Wall Street, we're talking about markets when we're investing in our KiwiSaver or our managed funds, our share portfolio. It's looking great. But then when we look out there in Main Street, we look outside in the real world, it feels like, especially here in New Zealand, it kind of feels like things are just slowing down. Things are a little bit harder for everyday households and small businesses especially. So why have we seen such amazing returns in the last, say, 12 months, Rupert? What's going on?
Yeah, look, I think there's a couple of things. Let's be honest, it's about as good a time as you're ever going to get to be an investor right now. US stock market up 35% over the last 12 months. Every market in the world has been up majorly, apart from New Zealand or China. And so I think there's a couple of points in that, right? One is things are feeling pretty ugly here in New Zealand, because they are. It's pretty simple. And to be fair, the New Zealand stock market reflects that. The New Zealand stock market, I'm just pulling up my numbers in front of me, but the New Zealand stock market's been one of the worst performers over the last 12 months, kind of being down 1.3% versus the others that are all up. And so I think there are two things when you think about your KiwiSaver, when you think about your investment accounts. There is a combination of, first of all, there's the regional diversification. So we've talked heaps in the past about needing to diversify your investments across different geographies and different markets, because sometimes things go really well in some markets and then they go really well in other markets at other times. And we're clearly in a world where New Zealand's not looking that pretty right now. And that's because we don't have much innovation in our economy. We don't have much tech and we're highly exposed to China, which is also going really bad. The second point around it, which brings us into much more of a macro, Main Street does not equal Wall Street. And so if you think about the stock market, so the US stock market in particular, right, about 30 to 40% of the US stock market is tech, technology. And that's everything from Cisco, IBM, kind of who make hard component parts, all the way through to NVIDIA, making the, well, those parts as well, I guess, making the chips, but super high tech, all the way through to Facebook. And so it's really interesting, right? That's 30 to 40% of the market, but I don't know, it might be 10% of the broader economy. The broader economy is made up of much more real, tangible things that people have to work really fucking hard for. And there's things like the service economy. And so that means restaurants, bars, cafes, things like farming, agriculture, construction, all of these things that make up massive chunks of our economy, but actually aren't that well represented in the stock markets, because they've never delivered very good return on capital, and therefore haven't been great investments for external investors in the past. So that's, I think, the real dichotomy. You always end up with, you can end up with an economy in a world that doesn't feel great, but you still have a stock market that's absolutely racing. And saying all of that, I mean, cost of living crisis means people are feeling poor. People are feeling pretty hard done by all over the world right now. But, I mean, US GDP growth this year at a real level is still going to be 2 to 3% in the US. And in New Zealand, we've still got GDP. I mean, sorry, we've still got unemployment in that 3.8 to 4% number, which is considered maximum employment. So it's kind of, it's been a really interesting economic time. People are struggling because they can't afford to do anything. Their mortgage rates have made life unaffordable. Food prices have gone nuts. Everything has gone nuts. But anyone that wants to work can still work. The mass wave of redundancies that we kind of expect when we start to see the start of a downturn, we haven't quite seen that yet, which is actually really interesting because anecdotally we're hearing about it, but it hasn't yet come through in any of the unemployment numbers.
I've definitely seen that. The redundancies pick up massively in the last, well, even just in the last 2 weeks, people calling me and telling me how a third of their employees are going to be losing their jobs in the next 6 months, and they don't know what it means for them. There's that that's happening, and maybe the maximum employment that we're at is really people really struggling to make ends meet, and so they have more than one job. And so how do you kind of measure that, right?
Well, I think there's two things. One is often people will say unemployment is a lag factor, and so we start to see that that kind of generally rolls over after when we're at the bottom or we've been through the bottom of the economic times. And anecdotally, I mean, we've talked a few times on the show about the likes of the Bunnings, the Mitre 10s, the supermarket, which are getting record applications for night staff at the moment. And that's because people need extra work. They want to kind of pick up extra shifts outside of their day jobs, which is, I think, really scary. To me, though, that reflects the cost of living crisis more so than kind of the general economic sentiment.
Yeah.
But in saying that, minus 3% GDP growth on a per capita basis in New Zealand, that is fucking ugly.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? And again, it's that difference that when you look at something, you kind of assume, hey, New Zealand is this nice, homogenous basket of everything is the sameness. But then when you look really closely, there's different layers, and there'll be people that are just sailing through these times, and it's just record year after record year, and they're just killing it. And then there's other people that have to work at a nighttime shift at Bunnings just to make ends meet. I guess that's like the whole dichotomy. And that, we see that not just in New Zealand, but that we see that everywhere in the world, like in the US, which is kind of the majority of what we read and watch about, seems to be US-centric in terms of the data points. It's no different. And that's why I think it's quite interesting that the performance in the like the last year, 30% up is what the US equities is. Like that's phenomenal. And I was talking to a client about this yesterday because we were trying to decide how to allocate their investments, what their portfolio allocation should be, how much they should they attribute towards US markets. And this came up that they felt really uncomfortable that, hey, that's where all the performance is, but that to me feels really scary as well, they were saying. And that's kind of where you have to kind of pull back and go, well, it doesn't really matter so much how it makes you feel when you look at that. You always have to revert back to the science behind why you still have exposure towards these big markets. You don't know when they're going to pop, when they're going to keep going. Usually it's completely counterintuitive, right? But like the fact that they performed so well, like that doesn't necessarily mean that people should sell it all right now. But what's your thought on that?
Well, I think you got to look at the underlying fundamentals, right? And there's two things that I look at right now. I mean, so we've just been through reporting season in the US. And in the US, 76% of companies that are reported Q4 earnings have beat estimates and have upgraded their earnings estimates. Companies are now looking at 11% earnings growth over the next kind of 12 months. That's pretty impressive, right? That's up there in terms of kind of historical averages. So companies definitely aren't feeling it. You look at a company like NVIDIA. I mean, we talked about this last week. NVIDIA, everyone says, oh, it's gone too far. It's gone too far. Share price is up 400% over the last 12 months.
Yeah.
Their earnings are also up 400%. So it's not actually, there's, I think, we're very quick to kind of write stuff off and go, it's pop, so therefore it's done. Mm-hmm. But actually, we need to look at the underlying factors in a lot of these companies and a lot of these things to understand, actually, is there more that can happen and where we're at? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so there's not. It's not necessarily true that, because I know that there's a little bit of a cynical saying that whenever you see a fund provider, like a managed fund, perform really, really well, like hit the number one spot, then watch out, they've probably got really negative performance afterwards, right? I guess it just goes to show that it's more about human nature and how we view markets rather than what markets are actually at. We would assume that, but it doesn't necessarily imply that markets have to behave the way that we think they should.
Massively. And then, I mean, coming back to the US market, what I find absolutely amazing is, I think if you looked at kind of some of that top, I mean, I don't know the exact stats, but probably 10 out of the 20 largest companies in the world right now have all been bred and have come out of those kind of top Ivy League universities in the US, right? Those universities have managed to create this amazing ecosystem of innovation and creation that nowhere in the world has, nowhere else in the world has. And it's managed to feed an ecosystem which starts at the universities, which drives these super driven, innovative people They've got capital pools that are around in those regions as well, which drives a venture capital ecosystem, which is amazing, because then that what that does is that means that people have an idea, they've got a shot, they can really easily get money to give it a big go, and then it kind of transitions through to the more mature growth markets, which is where companies go when they need to IPO and a lot of those venture things. And nowhere else in the world does that ecosystem exist. And that's one of the reasons why I absolutely love the US market, because as an investor, that's what I want. I want to get access to that ecosystem. And it's awesome.
Yeah. You want to own the technology at the creative stage, knowing that there's like an assembly line that's in place that actually works over time, right?
And it's even, it comes back to, and we're going way off topic here, but even talking to the education system, right? Where we look at the CEOs and founders of so many of these big companies, and they've come from overseas. And how do they get to the US? Because they come to the US to do the university. And so whether it be Satya Nadal whether it be the CEO of Microsoft, who kind of Indian background, came to do his MBA in the US, never left, whether it be CEO of Google, whether it be CEO of Snowflake, it's amazing what these education centers do in terms of bringing talent into that country. And that's what ends up on the stock market, which is why I love it.
Yeah. Yeah. Now it's so much easier to get into the US with the Mexico border opening up as well. So I just imagine that. Oh, dear. Anyway, let's stay on the US though. And I look increasingly to the US. I used to hate kind of looking at the United States for all things entertainment and now all things economic news. But in reality, there's so much central bank synchronicity happening since March 2020, and even before that, actually, that it's ridiculous. And so you kind of have to look for the lead of what could be happening, say, here in New Zealand, based on what the U.S. Fed is doing. And Jay Powell is doing his thing and coming out. I'm not sure how to kind of describe his tone, because it seems like it's either one or the other, right? It's going to either be hawkish, you think interest rates need to go up, or dovish, you think interest rates need to go down. And there seems to be this hawkish message with dovish overtones, you know, and vice versa. And it feels kind of like you can't really listen anymore to what they say. You just have to watch what they do, because they're going to flip-flop and contradict each other all the time. I'd be keen to know why you think that is. To me, it feels like they're relying on data, which is backwards looking all the time. And I know that there shouldn't be any political interference, so it surely has nothing to do with the election year. But then again, at the same time, I think there's probably this bias to always support the incumbent government in charge. So what do you think is driving the tilts at the moment? Or what do you think is on the mind of Jerome Powell in terms of which way interest rates will go this year?
I think there's two things on their mind right now. One is they're acknowledging how wrong they got it over the last 2 or 3 years. And that was everything from the start point of 2020, way too much stimulus, locked it in for way too long. The next big mistake was, and that's a forgivable mistake, and I think that's one that kind of hindsight's the only thing that can tell that. The next one was this whole idea of transitory inflation. Is it transitory? Is it entrenched? Where are we at? And they got that so wrong for so long, despite everyone telling them that they were wrong. And so now they're sitting there going, we've actually got no idea. And I think they are really going, look, on one hand, we can't crush the economy because our political masters will kill us. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, we can't kill it. We kind of can't let inflation go on for too long, because we know that the 1970s and what that taught us and what that did. So look, I'm probably slightly more or slightly further away from the conspiracy spectrum. I just think that the honest truth is they have no idea, and they are petrified of any decisions that they make. And so the less decisions they can make, the better. And then the second big part of it is they want to be adamant that they're not going to get bullied by the markets. So the markets in the last probably 6 to 9 months have been doing a great job at telling them enough's enough, enough's enough, enough's enough. And let's be honest, no matter what the central banks kept on telling them and do keep on telling them, they just say, okay, well, we're going to put in rate cuts in the next 6 months. And so no matter what the central bank says, that doesn't really change that core market case. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's their other frustration, is that the market's getting ahead of where they want them to be. So they're kind of saying, okay, we're done. We're kind of coming to the end of this. And then bang, all of a sudden, markets are priced in a March rate cut. Mm-hmm. That's what happened in December. And that means that wholesale rates fall, all the interest rates fall. And so financial conditions have eased materially before the Fed have even actually had a chance to kind of move. And so I think those are the two dynamics that the Fed's really struggling with. It's kind of the fear of doing anything because they've got it so wrong for the last 2 or 3 years, plus the jitterish nature of markets at the moment and the fact that markets have been consistently easing ahead of when the Fed would like. And the only way you can deal with that, unfortunately, is to stay hawkish for longer, which is why I personally believe that they will come down this year. In New Zealand, I think they'll come down sooner and harder than most people expect. But I think the problem is you've got to talk really, really hawkish until you're ready to cut, because otherwise the market's going to do it all for you.
Yeah.
And the cuts are going to be done before you're ready. So that's the challenge they have.
Yeah, it's really interesting, isn't it? It's a credibility game, isn't it? Like, I guess they want to be seen to be in control of markets. Fair enough. The market wants to be in control of itself. Fair enough. It's that whole classic tussle between, I guess, free market dynamics and a controlled economy. Just playing out in a...
Oh, it is. It's playing out. But what's really interesting this year, so you mentioned the election year issue in the US. There's never been a rate cut within kind of 3 or 4 months of an election. Mm. And so I think that's a really interesting dynamic that we're all thinking about now. Going, okay, well, if it wasn't an election, most people are sitting there going, okay, Q3, Q4 rate cuts make sense. Mm. But actually, what's the latest time that you can make a rate cut without being kind of seen to be influencing the election?
Yeah, that's right.
Does that actually mean that they have to go in May or June and they have to go bigger than they otherwise would in May or June?
Mm.
Because otherwise, yeah. And so now it's, look.
Well, actually, you know what you're saying and what I've been kind of starting to say is really kind of really aligned in a weird way.
Yeah.
Because my personal view is that I think New Zealand will follow the U.S., And I think they're going to do that strategically because it gives them a little bit of an advantage, even though it might not necessarily be the right thing to do. I think a lot of countries need to follow the U.S. But I wonder, because of what you're saying around the elections, if we'll see a rate cut sooner in the U.S. that will catch people off guard. And that's why you'll see it sooner in New Zealand as well, right?
You and I differ on this slightly. But why would you ever want to be a public servant? I mean, you're just lining yourself up for an absolute hiding, right? You look at someone like Jay Powell, even Adrian Orr, they're doing their best. And I don't think they've done extremely bad jobs with the information they've got at hand. Yet they're turning themselves into some of the most vilified people. And it's not even just the general public that vilifies them, but it's actually their political masters as well. And so I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, why would you ever be a public servant in this environment?
Well, you're a sucker for punishment. That's why.
True. I mean, these are smart guys. I mean, they can make a lot more money doing other things. And I think we've also got to be really careful in how we have some of these conversations, because we need these people to be doing these jobs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah. You kind of want to respect the office of these roles so that you don't kind of bring the whole system into disrepute, right? And kind of tarnish it.
Exactly.
And so, yeah.
I mean, imagine what's going to happen in... We have a October rate cut in the US, and imagine Donald Trump's reaction. I mean, and basically Jay Powell is guaranteed to be fired on kind of what the inauguration is on the 5th of January, so on the 6th of January. Mm-hmm. And you kind of sit there and you go, like, that's just wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, what happened last time Trump got in, right? Like, I think he was on the phone. He was on the blower, like, nonstop, trying to get those rates changed, right? So... Interesting times, man. Okay, well, let's talk now about China. We kind of alluded to it before.
The opposite.
Yeah, the opposite. That's right. The yang for the yin. Pun not intended necessarily. But we talked about it before with New Zealand, how directly and indirectly our economy is suffering because China is suffering. So we suffer because we're selling to them directly, but also via Australia, we're suffering too. And there's another layer that's going on that we should always be mindful of, where there is a separation between our security partner and our trading partner, China, US. Yep. And that's kind of, that's really interesting to dig into that as well. But when we look in the China world, we see a lot of tensions picking up. It's a falling property market. We got a declining population, unpredictable government, and effectively there's influential people saying that, hey, now China is not investable. Finally, though, they're stepping in and the government's trying to stimulate growth again. What are your general views? Can they pull up before they hit the mountain here, or are they going to crash and bring the rest of the world with them?
I think it's a really hard ask for them, right? Because so many times in the past, they have managed to pull up and they have kind of averted that last minute crisis with a huge amount of government spending and government stimulus, whether that be property development, whether that be infrastructure and railways to nowhere, all of that kind of stuff, right? Mm-hmm. The real question, what that did though, is that created a false economy. And I think what we're seeing in China right now is kind of the long-term impacts of what happens when you try and wean yourself off this massive government stimulus and these massive government packages over the medium term. And so I think the short answer is, could they do it if they really wanted to? Yes. Chinese government's got more than enough money to kind of put through some more stimulus packages, to bail out property companies, bail out property owners, do everything that they need to be. But I don't think they've got any desire to do that, because that sets himself up for another crisis in 3, 4, 5 years' time. Basically, the moment it feels as though they are trying really, really hard to break this boom-bust cycle, and then the bust being kind of cushioned on the downside by the government on the way through. The problem is they're doing it at a time where they've got these other massive macro issues. So you kind of, when you think about population decline, so 2 years now, population decline, and they're only starting to see where it's going to go, right? So we've talked in the past, over the next 50, 60 years, the population goes from 1.4 down to 800-900 million people. That is huge. You've got the geopolitical tensions where you've all of a sudden, now you've got industrial capacity in significant amounts of excess capacity, because all this reshoring or friendly shoring, whether it be moving manufacturing to Vietnam, Mexico, the US, and to Europe, that's created some of these big issues. And it's meant kind of all of a sudden you've got all of this manufacturing capacity that is no longer full. And yeah, so there are some big issues there that will need to be resolved. And it's going to be really interesting to figure out how that happens. And you also have to come back to, what's the number one rule of an authoritarian regime? You survive in your legitimacy is the fact that you make people's lives better. The truth is, in China, people like the Chinese Communist Party because they have seen the development of what they have done for the country over the last kind of 30, 40 years. Similar to why Putin was very popular in Russia for the better part of the first 20 years of his regime. And so I think all of us need to be really scared of, if they can't fix this and if they can't figure out a way to restore economic growth, then what do you do next?
Yeah, it's a different style of society and government. And I'm not necessarily a fan of communism, just quietly, but maybe not that quietly. But I agree. Like, we kind of need to make sure that every nation state in the world is kind of doing better for their people. But I wonder if also that we're moving into a new world. Well, I know we're moving into a new world, but I wonder if we're moving into a place where nation states will actually start competing for people. Like, you know, New Zealand, our record immigration recently, and it's clear why they're doing that. We're trying to goose the numbers. We're trying to turn things around, and it works for the short term, depending on who you have coming in, right? It can work. And I just wonder if you think about China and their massive demographic problem, not helped by their one child policy. I just wonder if they started to get really aggressive with immigration as well. Would we see the tide turn? And would we then see nation states competing to make their countries as attractive as possible for these commodities, these people that can move across the world? Do you ever see that? Like, it seems like when we talk about Japan and China with these massive demographic issues, we kind of just look at them and go, well, too bad to be them, right? But maybe, I don't know, maybe they could change their methods and start calling people home.
Oh, look, who knows, right? That's the short answer is yes, that does have to happen, and it will and it should happen. I mean, the Western world have been competing for talent for the better part of the last 50 years. And we see it, New Zealand, 2.5% of our population and as inflows last year. Mm-hmm. So, look, yes, the issue is culturally. So a lot of these, and I'm well out of my depth here, but a lot of these Asian countries that just do not like or welcome immigration. And they haven't been very good at assimilating new immigrants. You look at Japan, right? Japan's had a falling population for the better part of the last 10, 15 years. And immigration is still frowned upon in that country.
Hmm.
And in Japan in particular, where you go, very high wages, high levels of living standards. So it is the logical answer, and it is an answer that should scare the shit out of a country like New Zealand, who relies on immigration for our economic model. But yeah, there's massive cultural change that is needed to happen before that starts to go. And unfortunately, what we do know, cultural change takes a very, very long time to happen.
Mm, that's interesting. Yeah, like I like being out of my depth with you, Rupert, because you're a good swimmer. So that's good. All right. Well, let's bring it into a landing. And I was just too into what you were just saying for me to actually think about the next discussion point. But the one thing I think that we really need to talk about is the portion of our portfolios, especially if you've been investing in the Kura KiwiSaver plan and you've chosen to allocate towards the crypto specialty fund, the portion of our portfolio that seems to be the one that's doing all the heavy lifting and the superstar, apart from the U.S. markets, is Bitcoin. And we've seen phenomenal increases in the last 2 weeks, especially. We're flirting with all-time highs right now. 69,420 is the number that I'm kind of looking at here. But I think it actually has to be close to $78,000 just to actually be a new all-time high after you factor in inflation, U.S. dollars. But we're getting very close, and we're seeing gold reach for all-time highs as well. We're seeing the S&P 500 reach all-time highs too. So what's going on here just in general? Is this just currency debasement that we're seeing reflected in markets, or is there something else going on, people moving up the risk spectrum?
Oh, I think there's a bit of everything. I think people are definitely moving up the risk spectrum.
Yeah.
I think people are a little bit nervous on where we are. At the same time, they're moving up the risk spectrum, but they're also nervous around where we are economically and around inflation and all that kind of good stuff, which is why we are starting to see some of these moves into alternative assets. And then crypto one, I mean, at the end of the day, crypto is purely supply and demand. And this is the bit that kind of shocks people when I talk to them about it. Crypto's, I mean, Bitcoin in particular, right? Let's be honest, it's all Bitcoin.
Yeah, it is.
It's a small asset class. Mm-hmm. It's kind of got a $1.2 trillion market cap.
Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't even make the top, top five in the S&P 500.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is a small asset. And so over the last couple of weeks, we've seen an extra $2 or $3 billion worth of inflows into these ETFs.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just created massive long-term buying. And I think that's the bit that we kind of will hope for with these ETFs. And that was the kind of the story that we talked about was a new type of buyer. It's a whole lot easier. It's going to create some more demand. The question now becomes, are we going to see, is that demand just going to kind of keep on pushing it skyrocketing? Or are we going to see some consolidation and a whole lot of these new buyers acting as dip buyers on the way through?
Mm.
It's what we saw about 6 weeks ago when the price dropped from 49,000 down to 40,000 after that initial rally around the approval of the ETFs. I suspect we might be into something similar here. I would be very surprised if we don't see a pullback. And the hope is that we get a whole lot of these new buyers stepping in and buying the dips on the way through. So, I mean, my extremely wishful thinking is that we end up in a world where the volatility of the asset class reduces because we end up with more buyers and a more dispersed buyer universe and people that are more willing to easier to step in during those dips. So hopefully we're just starting to see the start of this thesis play out. But as we know with crypto, whenever you think you've kind of got it figured out and you understand anything, you get proven very wrong very shortly.
And which is why it's such a great asset class to be involved in if you're an everyday investor, because it teaches you about so much about investing and a lot about psychology as well. But like, I'm looking at this and I just wrote down a few things here. What you were saying is true. Like with the exchange traded funds, the ETFs, that's introducing a whole new type of retail layer to Bitcoin that wasn't there before. And they'll act differently, won't they?
Oh, it's not even retail. It's wholesale, institutional as well. All of a sudden you've got, I mean, you think about hedge funds. Hedge funds absolutely love the idea of playing, of kind of buying dips and being active traders. Hedge funds have struggled to play in the Bitcoin space historically because of how hard it is. Now they just use their existing infrastructure, their existing mandates. It's all pretty easy, right? And so I actually think it's this, to be fair, to me, the ETFs are less aimed at retail and are going to be far more aimed at the institutional layer, which is where the real money sits.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. No, that's, we'll give you that one. I didn't think about it like that. And I guess just on that as well, you also have wealth managers, family offices, high net worth individuals now who it probably takes time for the Bitcoin allocation to get onto the menu and then for people to actually start having the discussions and for the funds to actually start properly flowing. And I wonder if there's a little bit of a delay there and we haven't really seen that yet.
There will be, right? And there'll be a lot of advisors and asset allocation advisors and wealth advisors that historically have used the answer. It's too hard. It's too risky.
Yeah.
We're not going to buy through an exchange.
We're not going to get paid for it.
Or we're not going to hold it on an exchange. Yeah. So we're going to lose it. Setting up a wallet, too hard. I'm not having anything to do with that. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, that excuse is gone, right? And saying that, the traditional views and the riskiness of the asset class mean that you'd be a very brave wealth manager or a very brave asset allocation specialist to kind of come out and say, hey, you should do this. But all of a sudden, the easy answers around why not to do it are disappearing.
That's right.
And so I 100% agree with you, Darcy. It's not an overnight change. It's something that will take kind of years to kind of flow through.
Yeah.
But that ease of acquiring and the ease of doing business is really going to change things.
That's right. And you even just take slightly tangential, but the market cap of NVIDIA, what's that? Is that just over $2 trillion?
It's about $2 trillion.
Yes, it's almost twice as much as Bitcoin. And I don't know. Like if I was to think about 10, 20, 30 years in the future, AI is going to be a thing for sure. But Bitcoin, I don't know. It kind of feels like there's a lot of juice in the tank here, right? There's got to be a lot there.
And that comes back to a lot of the theory, right? So kind of where we say 3% of a portfolio. Yeah. I mean, you buy NVIDIA today, you buy an S&P 500 ETF, and NVIDIA is going to be 3%, 4%, right?
Okay. So,
I think as long as you're doing it in a measured way and you're not going all in, I think your parallel with NVIDIA is not materially different, right?
Yeah.
There's a lot of risk around NVIDIA and around the sustainability of its earnings base.
Yeah.
Admittedly, it does have an earnings base, whereas Bitcoin doesn't.
Yeah.
But there's quite a bit of stuff.
Yeah. And then two more things that I want to mention around the Bitcoin thing before we come to a landing. The first thing is central banks. Central banks have been gobbling up gold like nuts in the last few years. There's a big story as to why I think that is. But I also wonder if central banks will start to turn their attention increasingly towards Bitcoin as well and start acquiring that asset as a digital version of what they do in the physical realm. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I think that's a mine coming back to what we're talking about, the cultural shift in some of the Asian immigration. I think that's a mind fuck that's way too far for these people. What would not surprise me, though, is if we start to see some of the central banks and people around the world starting to buy stablecoins and starting to buy Tether and other things like that, right? Because actually, if you want US dollars, but you're nervous about the banking systems, you're nervous about some of that stuff, it's a no-brainer.
get it off.
That's where I actually think we might to see some central banks and some of those kind of state actors kind of participating.
Yeah,
it's in the stablecoin world versus in the world of actually buying the Ether or Bitcoin or that world, because they're not going to be able to get their heads around the volatility there.
Interesting, because in the crypto world, there's a saying, not your keys, not your coins. In the central banking world, if it's not your coins, you might not have any keys, i.e. you might actually lose control of the future financial system. And then that leads us to the halving, which is in theory going to do, it's not an exact date. It's not like you can have set up your halving party yet and book the restaurant and get the caterers ready yet. But in approximately 44 days time, approximately, the amount of new Bitcoin being mined will be sliced in half. And this is happening right around the time when inflows into these exchange traded funds, which means that there has to be actual funds gobbling up these Bitcoin. That's getting stretched massively. And I think that kind of is the last nail in the coffin of what should be the perma bear, or the person who's been thinking the whole time that it's a tulip mania. It's a bubble. It's a Ponzi scheme. Ponzi schemes don't keep coming back every 4 years. So this is kind of like, there's so many things here. And I know, of course, it's a speculative asset. People should do their own research and don't listen to too excited people like this, but, or one excited person about Bitcoin specifically. But there is a lot to suggest that things are going to go up and to the right with Bitcoin. But I guess nothing's for sure, is it? That's where we are.
Well, no, and nothing's for sure. And I wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't say there's also a hell of a lot of risk there that it might quickly fall to the left.
Whenever you're threatened on something, right? Yeah.
Exactly, right? But look, I think it's still, there's a lot of risk there. There's no question on it. But hey, our job as asset managers and asset allocators is to manage that risk. And that's all we're saying you should do, right? Yeah. It's got a lot of potential. But it all comes down to how much risk you should or be willing to take in there.
Awesome. Fantastic. Well, if you're watching, listening, and you haven't subscribed yet, make sure that you do subscribe to News of the Money World. People, thank you very much for joining us. And if you ever do have any questions, concerns, or comments, be sure to leave something in the comment section. Give us a like while you're there. So thank you very much, Rupert. It was great having the chat today.
Thank you, Darcy. It was an awesome conversation.
Cool. See you next week.